I like to create and build things. And I think that is the reason why I'm doing this. And now I build companies.
For Per Helsand, one of the most important aspects of leadership is building a culture of transparency, involving everyone at Cybrexa in all aspects of the company. In Per's experience, gained through founding and growing several companies, this approach helps provide insight into what's going on at the company and builds a sense of ownership and alignment with the mission. This, in turn, helps attract new employees who are passionate about Cybrexa's work and really want it to succeed. Per's approach has some things in common with the concept of T-shaped skills, in which each member of the company has the depth of expertise required to excel, while also enjoying a broad working knowledge of the company as a whole. These T-shaped skills are in contrast to I-type employees, whose lack of knowledge about other areas of the company makes it hard for them to collaborate in a team environment. Listen in now to hear Per's thoughts about building a culture of transparency at Cybrexa, and his thoughts about leadership in biopharma. I'm John Cimboli. You're listening to BioBoss. Today I'm speaking with Per Helsand, President and CEO of Cybrexa Therapeutics. Welcome to BioBoss, Per.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about Cybrexa.
How did you find yourself here at Cybrexa?
Yeah, so I'm at the core a serial entrepreneur. And prior to starting Cybrexa, back in 2010, I started an instrument company called Cyvec. And at Cyvec, we developed an automated microfluidic cartridge and instrument for measuring proteins in blood samples. And Cyvec was sold to Bio-Techne, a public company, in 2014. And after that acquisition, I decided that I wanted to go out and start another company. So Cybrexa is the result of that initiative. Essentially, started with a clean sheet of paper and went out looking for opportunities.
What was that process like as a sifting? In other words, was it like going to take a year and look at 500 companies, or was it kind of like, this one looks pretty interesting?
There were a few things that we, a few parameters that we set. So I really wanted to do something in oncology. I was exposed to oncology at Cyvec, as that was one of the primary areas where the instrument was used, and it was used pretty broadly in cancer research. And my mother was battling cancer my mother-in-law had cancer. So a lot of kind of exposure to cancer. And also, it's a large market with a lot of opportunity, both in terms of financial opportunity and the opportunity to make a difference for cancer patients. So really, we knew it was going to be something in biotech and really wanted to focus in on cancer. So we did have some parameters to work within. And eventually, I came upon this technology that was originally discovered at Yale by a famous scientist by the name of Don Engelman for targeting tumors, and got excited about the technology and acquired a license to use the technology in cancer therapeutics, and then essentially launched Cybrexa in January of 2017, acquired a facility at Science Park, which is right adjacent to Yale, and built out a team, and everyone's been doing a great job and moving the technology forward ever since.
Several, I would say many of the founders and CEOs I've spoken with, and I think it's close to 20 at this point for this program, Per, have said something along these lines: this being a biopharma CEO, it's not for the faint of heart. So I would say, of all the things you could have chosen to do when you were thinking about being venture capital, this had to be one of the more difficult ones to say, yeah. So how did you work through that?
One of the things that we liked about this particular opportunity was that we were using a peptide, a tumor-targeting peptide technology to improve existing drugs. So to take existing drugs and move them into new patient populations. So we kind of looked at it as a lower risk means of getting into biopharma, and where we could potentially get the multiples that you see in biopharma with a lower risk profile, and also a faster path to market, which also means that we can help people sooner. So that was part of the, you know, part of the thinking. And I think that sort of eased, you know, some of the distress around or concerns around jumping into biopharma.
I know it's often very difficult to foresee where things will go when you're starting up something, but I want to ask this question. What were you hoping to achieve that could be done, you thought, at Cybrexa that could not be done someplace else?
So every day we learn more about cancer biology and the tumor microenvironment in ways to leverage both to fundamentally change the course of disease. And unfortunately, we haven't cracked that code yet, but we believe that it is important that we continue to use every tool that we have at our disposal while we continue to look for new targets. So an untapped area that we're focused on is improving the therapeutic index, and by doing so, expanding existing drugs into new tumor types in patient populations. So we think it's important that we leverage what we know about the effectiveness of existing drugs and expand their use into new patient populations and applications. And through this, we believe that we can change the standard of care and ensure that we have fully exploited our existing knowledge of cancer and cancer biology. So, you know, what we're really looking to do is be successful in taking some of these existing drugs and making them available to patients that currently don't have option to use these drugs, or in a lot of cases don't really have any viable options.
So when you meet someone for the first time, perhaps through your family, and they say, what do you do for a living, Per? How do you answer that? I'm sure it'll vary quite a bit.
So I generally say I run a biotech in New Haven that is developing new cancer therapeutics based on groundbreaking tumor targeting technology that was developed at Yale. So we're looking to take drugs and deliver them specifically to the tumor while sparing normal tissue. So in doing so, avoiding some of these horrible side effects that everyone's familiar with that are typical of existing cancer drugs. And I really believe that we're going to change the standard of care in certain tumor types.
If it's a 10-year-old kid in a family that says, Mr. Helson, what do you do each day? Not the broad answer you just gave me, but how do you spend your time? How do you answer that?
A lot of what I do is around, setting goals, recruiting the right people and managing the right people and creating, you know, the right culture. So I'm not a biologist. My expertise is in building and managing companies. So, you know, I need to make sure that we have clear objectives. And most importantly, I need to make sure that we build a culture where people are passionate about what they do and people like to come to work. I want to have a company where people are coming to work and they're working hard because it's what they love to do, not because they're worried about some repercussions resulting from bad behavior. So I think the most important thing I do is around building culture and setting the objectives and the mission for the company.
Can you remember way back when you picked 8, 9, 10 years old, something like that, and we all had a self-image of what we wanted to be when we grew up, but we had no idea what that meant. But sometimes it connects and sometimes it doesn't. Do you remember that?
I always liked, tinkering with things, and I was really obsessed with motorcycles and cars. And my father was an engineer, so I think at the time I assumed that I was going to be an engineer because that's what my father did. And I think the way this kind of translates into, and I am an engineer by training, I'm not a biologist, but I like to create and build things. And I think that is the reason why I'm doing this. And now I build companies. And that's essentially, you know, you talked about, you know, my role and how I fit into running these companies based on my skill set and, my background, and that's really what I do. I build companies.
Did you give any consideration to going toward a big company and trying to take advantage of all the facilities and strengths and money and everything else that a big company can offer versus starting something from scratch?
You know, I didn't. You know, I've never worked for a big company. I've always worked for smaller companies, and the first company I started was actually started out of a small company, you know, probably a 200 people a person company. And that was in my late 20s. So I've kind of been running companies, you know, pretty much my whole career. And it's, you know, it's what I like to do. And, you know, at this point, I can't imagine going to work for, you know, for a large company. So, you know, I think, you know, one of the things I tell people when they come to, you know, come for interviews is that, you know, a lot of folks are concerned about working for a startup, particularly if they've come from, you know, from a big company. But, you know, what I tell them in today's environment, you know, these are different types of startups, particularly when they're run by experienced management team. They're well funded. You know, we're not wanting for, you know, for equipment or resources. And what happens is, and once again, you know, this is my perspective, never having worked at a large company, but things move a lot faster. People get to see the, you know, the results of their work sooner, and they get to be involved in a much larger portion of the business. You know, one of the things that is really important to me in building culture is transparency and involving everyone in all aspects of the company. So I like folks to know, you know, what we're doing, not just, you know, if you're a biologist, you're not relegated to just learning about biology and understanding that part of the company. We like people to understand everything that's going on. So you get exposed to a lot more. And I think in doing that, people have a more of an ownership of the company and the mission. And you tend to attract and mentor people that are really passionate about what you're doing and really, really want it to succeed. And to me, it's incredibly rewarding and exciting.
That sounds like your heart is in this idea of a collaborative work culture. And I imagine either where you are or previous places, you probably had that opportunity to really bring someone along, perhaps introduce them to a new area or find some strength that there's, you know, maybe they didn't even know. Is that part of what's going on?
Yeah, I think that is part of it. And I think exposing people to a different environment and kind of a new way of doing things. And I've had on a few occasions, I've had folks come back to me and kind of, you know, years later and send me an email and, you know, and thank me. And that's probably one of the greatest feelings I've ever had. Definitely part of what, you know, what draws me. And I think a lot of folks into, you know, building and running companies, because like you said, it's not easy.
What's new at Cybrexa?
We're rapidly moving our lead program toward the clinic. We plan to dose our first patients early next year. And we're looking to recruit patients that have a high unmet need despite advances in immuno-oncology and other new therapies such as third-line small cell lung cancer, third-line non-small cell lung cancer, and colorectal cancer. So the program is moving along very well. We've received positive feedback from the FDA on our pre-IND filing. So that means that they're supportive of our plans and on board for us moving forward. Our plan is to file an IND by the end of this year and move into patients, as I mentioned, you know, first part of next year. So we're in the process of going through IND enabling tox studies, which we plan to wrap up in early December. So we'll enter a phase one study in advanced solid tumors. So these are patients that, you know, where there's a, you know, very, very high unmet need, don't have many, if any, options. And we've also identified several paths to market that could get us there in under 5 years. So we're pretty excited about the possibility of moving some of these into the market fairly quickly.
In part of my reading, I came across the Hartford Current article about your hope to make a drug that was both more effective in terms of reducing the size of the tumor, but also have less of the, you know, terrifying side effects that patients sometimes experience. Can you talk to me about that second part of it, how that plays into what you're trying to do?
You know, the fundamental mechanism of our technology is fairly easy to understand. So it's a peptide that was discovered at Yale, as I mentioned, and this peptide works by leveraging the low pH or acidic environment that's present on the surface and the microenvironment immediately surrounding cancer cells. And it's important to understand that that this low pH is a fundamental. This low pH environment results from fundamental cancer cell metabolism. So our targeting technology is broadly applicable across all solid tumors. So when this particular peptide comes in contact with this low pH environment, it reacts by going through a transformation where it protonates and forms an alpha helix. You can think of it as a corkscrew, and essentially drills through the surface or the membrane of cancer cells and stays there until the cell is destroyed. So we're using this to provide intracellular delivery of small molecules. So as opposed to just administering the molecule systematically and having it go, you know, more preferentially to cancer cells, but also attacking healthy cells, we're delivering it specifically into the cancer cells, and we're actually preventing it from going into healthy cells because the peptide will not translocate into these healthy cells because of the pH. You can almost, you know, some folks, if in layman's terms, describe it as a, you know, as a heat-seeking missile or a smart bomb, where it's very, very targeted and very specific delivery. So what this does is it offsets these toxic side effects, which, you know, GI tox is very typical. Bone marrow tox is really typical, and bone marrow tox is one of the ones that usually limits the potential of these drugs. Some of these drugs will be working well on a patient, but they have to come off them because it's destroying the bone marrow, which of course, you know, compromises the immune system and becomes unsustainable. So in some cases, we're taking, you know, in the case of our lead candidates, we're taking drugs that are known to be effective at killing cancer cells. We know these drugs work, but the problem is they don't have much in the way of what's called a therapeutic index, which is the delta between the amount of damage you do to cancer cells versus the amount of damage you do to healthy cells. So by targeting these drugs, we're able to make them effective, safe, and much more tolerable.
When you're making a presentation and you get the chance to say, to describe what you just described to be, obviously in some detail, and then you find after the meeting perhaps that the person says, many of the people say, yeah, okay, I got it, Per, and you're thinking, okay, they understand where we are. We'll see if they're interested or not. A certain number will come back probably and say, oh, thank you for telling me that it's X, when in fact, that's not what you said at all. It's just a disconnect. When people get it wrong, what do they get wrong, then how do you help them figure it out?
I think one of the things is they don't appreciate the differentiation between other tumor targeting technologies. So anytime you set an ambitious goal, like killing cancer cells without harming healthy cells, there are bound to be failures and setbacks, and tumor targeting is no exception. And, you know, that said, we believe we're now in a new era where ADCs and other tumor targeting technologies are coming into their own, and we're starting to see some big successes. But there are some key differentiators with our technology, one being the universality of the technology, and that we're targeting this low pH environment that's universal across all cancer cells. You can essentially look at us as targeting cancer, as opposed to targeting a specific mutation or an antigen that's specific in a subset of patient populations. So I think a lot of times folks miss the value proposition that we can go much broader than ADCs, and that we're not looking to compete with ADCs in the space where they're successful. We're essentially looking to go where they're not. So I think that's one of the key things that people, you know, tend to miss. And I think it's really important in terms of creating value to an investor, but also in terms of, you know, helping patients.
When you help them to understand that the way you just did for me, do you sometimes get the follow-up question, yeah, that sounds great, Per, but you're a small company, that sounds pretty ambitious.
You know, I don't know that the skepticism is so much around the, you know, the size of the company, but I think a lot of folks say, yeah, you know, your data, your preclinical data, data in animals looks great. I mean, I don't think anyone would dispute that that our preclinical data demonstrating that we can preferentially target tumors and spare normal tissue in animals is very compelling. So, you know, the question is, okay, well, you know, how do we know that's going to translate into humans? So I think that's, you know, a lot of times where, you know, folks aren't willing to take the leap or take the risk. So I think that's probably where, and I don't even know if it's skepticism, it's just folks want to see it translate into, you know, into humans.
What can you tell me about the pipeline at Cybrexa and how it helps to differentiate the company?
So one general kind of philosophy I want to mention before going to the pipeline is that in using this technology to target existing drugs, we're not looking to target these drugs solely for the purpose of reducing the adverse effects and making them more tolerable to patients and improving quality of life, although that's great. We're really looking for opportunities where through targeting, we can move these drugs into new patient populations, into patient populations that currently don't have access to them, because we feel that's where we can both create the most value and help the most people. So that said, right now we're focused on cytotoxics and DNA repair inhibitors. So we have two cytotoxics. One is CBX-12, the other is CBX-13, and I'll talk a little bit more about those. And then we have two DNA repair inhibitors. One is a PARP inhibitor and one is a proprietary molecule that hits three of the four primary DNA repair pathways, ATM, ATR, and DNA-PK. So in the case of the cytotoxics, our lead program is CBX-12, and we're targeting a class of drug called a TOPO1 inhibitor, topoisomerase inhibitor, and the specific molecule is exatecan. Now, exatecan is currently being targeted by an ADC and a drug called Enhertu that was a collaboration between Daiichi and AstraZeneca. It was recently approved by the FDA. There's a lot of buzz about the program, its potential. It's projected to hit $3 billion in annual sales in 2024. So that particular drug is being targeted by an ADC that targets a HER2-positive antigen. So by definition, it is relegated to tumor types and patient populations that express HER2. So what we're doing is we're taking that same drug and plan to target it with our technology, which, as we've been talking about, is universally applicable across all solid tumors, and go outside of HER2 positivity. So our plan is to, at least initially, to go where they're not, to go into patients that could benefit from these topoisomerase inhibitors, but that don't have HER2 mutations. Similarly, CBX-13 is a drug class of drug called a maytansine. The specific molecule is DM4, and it's a more potent version of the DM1 that's in the Roche HER2-positive breast cancer drug, Kadcyla. Once again, the plan is to go beyond or outside of HER2 positivity. In the case of the PARP inhibitor, the plan is to combine that with the DNA damaging agent. So PARP inhibitors are currently relegated to patient populations that have a BRCA mutation, or more broadly, some kind of homologous recombination deficiency. So the PARP inhibitor needs a defect or a deficiency to exploit in order to work. So what we're going to do essentially is artificially induce that deficiency with a DNA damaging agent. And this isn't a new idea. In fact, it was the concept behind the first PARP inhibitor that ever went into a trial. But the problem is they ran into severe bone marrow tox. And in fact, all of the companies that have PARP inhibitors on the market have run phase one trials where they've attempted to do these combinations, and they've all failed due to bone marrow tox. So our plan is to kind of go back to that concept, and our preclinical data once again demonstrates without question that we can combine a PARP inhibitor with a DNA damaging agent in a very high dose and not impact the bone marrow.
I know day to day, moment to moment, you're really focused on taking these steps to get yourself to the next step and, you know, all the things you've been talking to me about. At this stage, do you also occasionally find yourself sitting back and thinking, you know, if this works, I'm going to really help some people? Or does that come later on after you allow yourself to?
No, I actually think about that a lot. And in fact, my mother is still battling metastatic breast cancer. It's been going on for 7 years. And she's actually in that category of patients that, you know, she's gone through essentially all the, you know, the therapies that you go through when you have metastatic breast cancer, and she's kind of getting to the, you know, to the end of the line, and having to take drugs that are more toxic and that have, you know, worse side effects. So they start out with the, you know, the drugs that the best ones, and then, you know, with all these drugs, eventually people build up resistance and they go to the next line of therapy and the next line of therapy. And so, you know, she's been telling me that she's holding on because she wants to be enrolled in the, you know, in our phase one trial. So we're trying to, you know, move as quickly as we can. And, you know, she's hanging in there. So there's definitely that. Also, my last year, my sister passed away from lung cancer. So that's obviously one of the areas that we're targeting. So, yeah, I mean, I think a lot about getting these initially into the clinic, and then, you know, being able to, you know, to help these patients that don't have a lot of options.
Why did Cybrexa choose to locate in New Haven?
So one of the reasons was, you know, the technology was originally discovered at Yale by Don Engelman. But, you know, I think beyond that, there's a really nice ecosystem in New Haven. You know, one of the things that's most important to us is being able to have access to a talent pool. And this, you know, this biotech ecosystem that's building in and around Yale and New Haven is attracting a lot of talent. And also, we have a lot of very talented folks here left over from when Connecticut was a center, you know, for biopharma, and we had all the big, you know, the big biotech companies. So, you know, I think probably the most important factor for us is having access to good people. I mean, that's what makes these companies successful, and we've had really good luck in recruiting folks. And, you know, and we like the, you know, we like the New Haven, you know, kind of biotech environment.
What kind of team have you set out to build there to make this culture happen you were just describing? What do you look for when you're trying to build that team?
One of the first things, you know, that I look for is, you know, is passion and, you know, fit to, you know, into our culture and the way we like to do things. For, you know, for me, that trumps, you know, technical acumen or talent. So, you know, when I interview folks, you know, I'm not looking to interview them about their technical abilities for the most part, because, you know, generally they're in fields that I don't, you know, that I don't have any expertise. But I'm looking for attitude and passion, and, you know, whether or not they're going to fit in with the culture. You know, and a lot of that falls on the, you know, on the senior leadership in terms of creating a culture where it fosters, you know, this type of environment where people work together, where they're collaborative, where there's open communication, where people are focused on the mission and the goals of the company because they want the company to succeed, not because of they're looking for some, you know, personal gain or trying to, you know, to climb the ladder or those other types of things. So it's really important to get the right culture. And, you know, one of the things I always tell people is once you get that working, you know, it's like the engine's running on all 12 cylinders. It makes, you know, the job of the CEO becomes so much easier if you have the right culture, because the company kind of, you know, almost runs itself. So that's why a lot of my effort is spent on, you know, on building and maintaining that culture.
And I do I also understand that there can be advantages in being in New Haven compared to some other places in terms of retention, that it's a good lifestyle. People may want to stick around a little while. That can be nice too.
Yeah, I think, you know, New Haven, you know, has a lot of the similar attributes to some of the you know, the larger biotech communities like Boston, New York, and California. You know, we've got the proximity, you know, to Yale that's got its own, you know, kind of culture and creates a certain type of environment that folks like. We've got UConn as well. But then I think beyond that, because it's smaller, both in terms of size and you know, geographic, just it's more contained. It seems to be a more tight-knit group than I think you'd see in some of the, you know, some of the larger biotech centers.
Being located in New Haven, how does that affect your ability to bring in capital and access investors that you would like to talk to?
So even though, you know, most of the big VCs, particularly, you know, the so-called blue chip VCs are located in Boston, New York, and California, I don't see it as a significant, you know, disadvantage there, particularly Boston and New York. It's an, you know, well, it was an easy commute, you know, prior to COVID-19, but you can still access these folks easily, you know, by phone, and everything's being done by video conference. And you're seeing significant investment in New Haven companies, and both private investment, and there are a number of companies that have gone public recently, a few of which, you know, reached multi-billion-dollar valuations. So you look at Arvinas, and you look at Biohaven. So I don't see that as a disadvantage. I thought that it might be, but as we started going out and aggressively looking to raise money from institutional investors, I don't see that as an issue at all.
What can the biopharma community learn from this experience of dealing with COVID and how it does its work, what it wants to do to help out in the future?
We've been very fortunate in that we've been able to continue on and have not missed or delayed any of our significant milestones. So we have a creative team. You know, we came up with ways to continue the work in the lab safely, and, you know, do social distancing and communicate from, you know, from home. So, you know, I think I'm fortunate that we were able to, you know, to continue on. And, you know, a lot of that goes out to, you know, having great people that, you know, that wanted to continue to work and figured out a way to do it, you know, do it safely.
If you were thinking about where the biopharma industry needs to turn its attention in the coming years, what would you be thinking? I know one person I spoke with recently said he's very interested in the idea of democratization and making drugs affordable in countries other than in North America and in Europe. Is there a series of issues that you're thinking about right now in terms of the future and what you want to put your energy into?
There's still a lot of work that needs to be done in oncology. I mean, we've made advances, but we're nowhere near having a cure or even having, you know, drugs that can, you know, turn it from a into a chronic kind of treatable illness. So, you know, I think continuing to study, you know, the underlying cancer biology and how it works is really important. I mean, what we're focused on is, and I think we talked about this before, but, you know, looking at, you know, what do we know today, and how can we leverage that, and how can we take, you know, existing therapies and existing knowledge and move those into patients and, you know, create therapies for folks that, you know, currently don't have options.
Thanks for speaking with me today, Per.
Thanks, John. It's been my pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about Cybrexa and tell the story.
While my work with leaders in the biopharma community puts me in touch with founders and CEOs around the world, my company's home base in the New York-Boston corridor gives me a close-up view of what Per calls the New Haven ecosystem. Per's description of the Cybrexa origin story provides insight into this New Haven ecosystem. Technology originally discovered at Yale University, The talent pool that springs from Yale and the large pharma companies who had built significant research facilities in Connecticut, and the nearby University of Connecticut campuses and technology incubator program. And then there's the attractive lifestyle. A U.S. Census Bureau report placed New Haven among the top areas where millennials have chosen to locate. But Pear's leadership role and the work of Cybrexa are much more than a story about the New Haven ecosystem. Pear's focus is squarely on patients and changing the standard of care they receive for certain tumor types. Sadly, one in two people in the U.S. are diagnosed with cancer during their lifetime, and Pear knows how much work remains to be done. I'm John Cimboli. You're listening to BioBoss.